$25,000 and 28% of those earning less than $25,000. Finally, food insecurity during the pandemic has varied by location as well. 10 states in the U.S. and the District of Columbia had the highest rates, ranging from Mississippi about 33.5%, which stood atop this group, to Alabama about 27%, which had the lowest. In between, in descending order, were Washington, D.C., Nevada, Louisiana, New York, New Mexico, Florida, Tennessee, and North Carolina.
Top stories: China's aircraft carrier group sails through the Taiwan Strait amid Beijing-Taipei territorial tensions, and a day after a U.S. warship transited the sensitive waterway. U.S. President Donald Trump's campaign makes a long-shot bid at the Supreme Court to challenge President-elect Joe Biden's victory in Pennsylvania. Also ahead this hour, many countries around the world banned flights to and from Britain as London said the spread of a more infectious new coronavirus strain was out of control. A Chinese aircraft carrier group has sailed through the sensitive Taiwan Strait on its way to conduct a military deal in the South China Sea. The Shandong carrier group sailed through the narrow strait a day after a U.S. warship transited the same waterway. Taiwan said it had dispatched a number of warships and aircraft to monitor the movement of the Chinese fleet. Tensions escalated between China and Taiwan after the U.S. approved multi-million dollar arms sale deals to Taipei last month. China considers the self-ruled island a breakaway province waiting to be reunited with the mainland. It maintains sovereignty over the region under the One China policy. The latest on that escalation from our man Stephen Ribe, standing by for us and coming to you via Skype out of Beijing. Stephen.
I think that what China says is standard in situations like these. It says this is only a routine transit to routine exercises in the South China Sea. That's what America always said when it did similar things. You see, you want to send out a message, which is certainly what China is doing by floating this pride of the Chinese Navy, this huge aircraft carrier, so close to Taiwan. But you don't want to make it look like you're the aggressor. It's interesting, as I said, that it used to be America playing these games with China to intimidate China. In 1996, for example, in response to Chinese troop maneuvers, which were in response themselves to an election being held in Taiwan, the U.S. floated or sailed two aircraft carrier groups up the Taiwan Strait and then said it was just a routine exercise. The individual transit is not that notable in itself. This Shandong aircraft carrier, which is China's first entirely domestically made aircraft carrier, did the same thing last December. What's significant here is the bigger picture. In the old days, America could sail its aircraft carriers, intimidate China. Now that's less easy to do because China is approaching parity with the United States. For example, in response to this latest sailing of a Chinese aircraft carrier, pundits have started debating what would happen in the event of a war. For example, last week, Taiwan launched a new class of stealthy, fast-moving corvette ships, armed to the teeth, designed for hit-and-run attacks against big Chinese ships. It's being nicknamed the carrier killer, but it's designed to attack all big ships. That's led other pundits to say, well, China could just attack these ships with helicopters from the air. More significant is that Taiwan is now commissioning a fleet of diesel-electric submarines. And when they're all in the water, which is supposed to be by 2025, they're going to be equipped with American hardware from Raytheon and Lockheed Martin. So that will make it harder. But as I said, what's significant now is people are actually talking about what might happen in the event of a war. Back in the day, 10, maybe 5 years ago, there was no doubt that America would win a war. It's also worth asking how much aircraft carriers would be used in such a war. You see, aircraft carriers are only for big nations to intimidate relatively defenseless smaller nations. If you've got the missiles, which Taiwan has, it's got surface-launched anti-ship missiles. China certainly has surface-launched anti-ship missiles, which are capable of taking out big ships, including aircraft carriers. Most analysts now believe that aircraft carriers are sitting ducks. And so it's debatable if there were a war for Taiwan, how much aircraft carriers would be used, because I think both sides can sink them now. So this, if you look at it that way, is really like some kind of braggadocio, some kind of big gesture. Both sides are making these big gestures. Although, as I said, if a war to have come about, it's debatable to what degree big ships like aircraft carriers would take part in this war.
Thank you very much. That's our man Stephen Rebe in Beijing. U.S. President Donald Trump's campaign has filed a long-shot bid at the Supreme Court to challenge President-elect Joe Biden's victory in the state of Pennsylvania. The bid was made in a petition that asked the justices to reverse the outcome of the presidential race. The case is filed nearly 7 weeks after Election Day and just a month before Biden is set to be inaugurated. It comes as Trump continues to say he has been cheated, and judges around the country have resoundingly rejected his and his allies' allegations of fraud. The challenge follows a similar suit brought by state of Texas, which the justices refused to hear earlier this month. Ronnie Carvalho says even if U.S. President Trump wins the bid, the election outcome will not change.
He's reaching 60. Well, he's with that one would be 58 cases that he's trying to win, and so far he lost all of them. One important thing that I need to mention about that is that the Supreme Court is already out. It won't be back until January 8th, 2 days after the Congress is set to meet and count officially the votes and proclaim the winner of the election. So, and even if he wins this this another try at the Supreme Court, won't change a bit the result, the outcome of the election. So I strongly believe that everything is regarding money. He's already reaching almost $300 million from his supporters that are donating money. So I think that, of course, the whole idea is to keep receiving money, those donations, and as much as he can push and keep going with that, more money will be coming to his pocket.
The U.S. Senate Republican leader says congressional leaders of both parties have agreed on a coronavirus relief bill that is worth hundreds of billions of dollars.
Is on the way. Moments ago, in consultation with our committees, the four leaders of the Senate and the House finalized an agreement. There'll be another major rescue package for the American people. If our citizens continue battling this coronavirus this holiday season, they will not be fighting alone. We've agreed to a package of nearly $900 billion.
The package is expected to include aid for vaccine distribution and logistics, extra jobless benefits, and a new round of stimulus checks. Senate Minority Leader Chuck Schumer also confirmed the agreement, stating that a vote will take place on the bill soon. This comes as the pandemic continues to take a heavy toll on American people, as well as the economy, which has been battered by rising jobless claims. COVID-19 has so far claimed over 317,000 lives out of more than 17.8 million cases in the U.S., the world's worst-hit country. Britain says significant differences remain with the European Union in negotiations over a post-Brexit trade deal. A senior British government official said talks would continue on Monday to explore every route to find a deal. Previously, the two sides had set Sunday as the deadline for the talks. Negotiations have been in particular stalled over the EU's fishing rights in British waters. A bloc's diplomat said if Britain does not accept the latest offer, there will be no deal. The two sides must get a deal by December the 31st. A no-deal scenario would mean border chaos for both sides and reliance on WTO rules that could possibly lead to price hikes. A number of countries have banned travel to and from the UK to prevent the spread of a more infectious strain of the coronavirus. The Netherlands, Belgium, Italy, France, Germany, Turkey, and Ireland have suspended or are planning to suspend flights to and flight status and train arrivals from Britain, I should say. A German government official says the entire 27-member European Union could adopt the restrictions. Iran has also announced a two-week halt in flights between Tehran and destinations in Britain. The World Health Organization has called on its European members to step up measures against the new variant circulating in Britain. British health officials say the new coronavirus variant spreads 70% faster than the original and is out of control. The government has imposed a strict Christmas lockdown in London and southeast England to rein in the spread of the virus. Austria braces for its third hard lockdown starting on December the 26th and lasting 3 weeks. The government says it will be rolling out free tests for the public after the lockdown. Homa Leski reports.
The Austrian government announces a third hard lockdown starting immediately after Christmas on the 26th of December. Chancellor Sebastian Kurz had promised that the second lockdown, which ended 2 weeks ago, would save Christmas, but that mission has proven to be nearly impossible. Like the majority of nations around the world, Austrians are not expecting a regular Christmas or New Year's Eve. But things don't look entirely bleak, as vaccinations are set to begin across Europe and Austria on the 27th of December. With every week, says Chancellor Kurz, we get a step closer to ending this pandemic.
Measures will become stricter until the seven-day incident is below 100, and in mid-January there will be free mass tests for everyone who wants to take part.
The goal is to keep weekly cases below 100 per 100,000 people. That number currently stands at just under 200. The lockdown is expected to end on January 18th, but only for those who agree to get tested. For those not willing to take the test, the stay-at-home order and curfew will be in place for another extra week. Health Minister Rudolf Anschober expressed concern over the dramatic increase in mortalities across the country over the last 2 months.
With no further measures, at the end of the month, new cases could range between 1,300 and 3,000 cases a day.
For now, the new restrictions mean everyone entering Austria from abroad has to go into a 10-day quarantine, which can only be cut short after 5 days with a negative PCR or antigen test.
Over the Christmas holidays, more contacts and therefore more cases are expected, and the latest preventive measures announced by the government are meant to bridge the time until the vaccine can be rolled out in the new year. Homa Leski, Vienna.
In Australia, a new cluster of COVID-19 has spread to over 50 locations in Sydney, prompting all other states and territories to close borders with the city. Authorities have urged the city's 5 million residents to get tested or self-isolate if they have visited the declared infected locations. Nearly 70 cases of infections of the new virus cluster have so far been reported, but the number is expected to increase. Dozens of domestic flights due to leave Sydney were also cancelled. Australia has largely avoided high coronavirus numbers compared to other developed nations, but the new cluster has sparked fears of a wider outbreak. The country has recorded just over 28,000 cases and 908 deaths since the pandemic began. A car caravan went through the streets of Barcelona to protest the controversial school reform approved by Spain's Congress of Deputies in November. Drivers blared their horns while passengers chanted slogans demanding the repeal of a clause that eliminates Spanish as a vehicular language. Kusai Kedri reports.
A nationwide car protest of a Spanish education reform reached Barcelona as the country grappled with a coronavirus pandemic. The procession, organized by a group advocating bilingual teaching in Catalonia, blocked traffic to draw attention to a law that will eliminate Spanish as a vehicular language in education. The reform, known as the Celá Law, in reference to Spain's education minister Isabel Celá, was approved by a majority of left-leaning lawmakers in Spain's Congress of Deputies in November. It was hailed as a major breakthrough in promoting equal opportunity in public and concerted schools, increasing funding and access to scholarships, and ending sex segregation. But the main bone of contention is the future of Spanish as a common language across the 17 autonomous regions. The deadlock over school reform takes special significance here in Catalonia, where the pro-independence movement has been gathering pace. Although Spanish is not the main language in most schools in this autonomous region, opponents of the reform say that consecrating a law that scraps Spanish as the common language ends their hopes for equality and emboldens the separatists.
We want to be free to pick the language that better suits our children in school. We've had enough with the language imposition. They do not allow us to speak Spanish here, or our kids are prohibited from learning in their mother tongue, which is Spanish.
On Thursday, Catalonia's Superior Court of Justice stepped in the debate, arguing that the teaching of Spanish in the region remains, quote, residual, and it urged authorities to teach a minimum 25% of the curriculum in Spanish, in addition to Spanish class. Education officials in Catalonia denounced the move as a breach of regional competencies and vowed to appeal to Spain's higher court.
The regional authorities in Catalonia have long disregarded court rulings. They've always been quick at trampling our freedom as citizens.
Spain's Conservative People's Party, center-right Ciudadanos, and far-right party Vox have so far failed to slow-walk the bill in its journey to final approval in the Senate. Kusai Kadri, Barcelona.
There is no let-up to pressure on Pakistan, reportedly from the UAE and Saudi Arabia, to normalize ties with Israel after some Arab countries diplomatically recognized Tel Aviv's regime. Pakistan's Prime Minister Imran Khan has rejected media reports on his country's preparedness to recognize Israel. He has once again vowed not to do so, citing a widespread public resentment against Israel. Javed Rana reports.
Being in Pakistan, their hearts are with you.
He's a Noordari, a man of Pakistani origin. He's heading a London-based anti-Muslim think tank, Islamic Theology of Counterterrorism. Dari is suspected to be sponsored by apartheid state of Israel. Dari, who left Pakistan almost 20 years ago, has been now at the center stage of what Islamabad says a lingering disinformation campaign propagating that Pakistan is getting ready to normalize ties with Israel.
Pakistan government, they want to establish a relationship with Israel. This is the reason they sent a delegation, and not only the one person, a couple of persons, including the advisor of the prime minister. They flew from the London to Tel Aviv.
The claim was immediately dismissed by Pakistani prime minister as baseless.
Why would our delegation visit Israel when we have a policy not to recognize Israel? It is clearly a fake news. In a democratic society like ours, it is unacceptable to normalize ties with Israel because our entire nation stands by Palestinians.
Pakistan has been reportedly under intense pressure from the UAE and Saudi Arabia after some Arab rulers normalized their ties with Israel, notwithstanding the seething public anger in their countries. Both the UAE and Saudi Arabia reportedly threatened Pakistan to expel its an estimated 4 million expatriates if Islamabad resisted their pressure to normalize ties with Israel. This followed a few news anchors who were encouraged by Pakistani military to start debating in favor of normalizing ties with Israel, an allegation denied by army known for calling shots in country's foreign policy making. The media outlets in the apartheid state even find it hard to speak with a credible Pakistani journalist.
Many Pakistani journalists would even decline to appear and speak with me, speaking with from our studio in Tel Aviv.
Pakistani journalists who spoke recently with the Israeli news channel are either tainted with the corruption charges or had desperation to come into limelight through controversies. Anyone supporting Israel in Pakistan meets with instant condemnation at social and mainstream media, given Israel's unending mass killing of Palestinians and their forcible expulsion from the Muslim Holy Land from 1948 to onwards. The major thrust of the argument of the lobbies working for Israel and its allies has been to cite Arab countries abandoning Arab nationalism in occupied Palestine for an independent Palestinian state. However, theologists point out that forcing Israel to withdraw from Islamic Holy Land is not an Arab cause, but in fact it is a greater cause of Muslim nationalism beyond color, creed, and geography, something which overwhelmingly prevails in Pakistan. Javed Rana, Islamabad.
A diverse range of programs. Youth. Spirituality. Culture. Eastern Tales. Roundtable discussions. Politics. All produced by IRIB English Radio.
Our website is www.parstoday.com/en.
The article you're about to hear has been authored by Igor Kuchma, who is a financial advisor, under the heading, After the Coronavirus Comes the Corona Deficit. Please stay with us. There are two types of viruses, computer and biological ones. Neither of them brings happiness to those who have been affected. However, they do leave important marks, and in some cases, the negative effects can last years or even trigger new issues. For example, the COVID-19 pandemic has not only caused health issues, but also led to a new financial crisis. It might have been seen as one of the shortest for financial markets, but we shouldn't be so naive. First, Indice's recovery was a result not so much of a good epidemiological situation, but monetary instruments implemented by the world's most influential central banks. The only problem is that they also have their own price. Here, we need to ask the first question. Who will pay for the COVID crisis bailout? Despite the fact that markets are near record highs, there are still millions of people across the world who haven't been able to recover their jobs. Thousands of companies were closed, and many probably will never open again. Based on a 9.2% unemployment rate in the U.S. in the fourth quarter of 2020, researchers initially predicted that bankruptcies would finish the year with a 140% increase. It is also important to mention that a U.S. company filing for bankruptcy doesn't necessarily mean it will disappear. Instead, bigger companies usually do this to restructure and settle on new repayment terms for their debts so they can remain open. Unfortunately, small and medium-sized enterprises can't normally afford such an option. For now, it may look like U.S. bankruptcy filings have slowed, but once again, we shouldn't be naive. The bank is yet to come. Many of the companies that should have closed down have simply been incarnated into zombie firms. They are neither dead nor alive. The amount of debt on their balance sheets is so high that any cash generated is being used to pay off the interest. Thus, the company can't grow as it doesn't have spare funds to invest. This in turn means it can't employ more people. To be fair, this problem is not new. It has been there for years, and the reason is cheap loans due to low interest rates. Many zombie companies survive by issuing new debt that will allow the funding of operating losses and interest payments. If you ask which sectors are on the radar, unfortunately, there won't be a clear answer. Basically, every sector is at risk, and the situation is only getting worse with additional lockdowns. It is also true that some companies do benefit from the situation, especially IT businesses. But even they could eventually suffer if the global economy enters a new crisis. But companies are not the only ones that have fallen into debt distress. According to International Monetary Fund, emerging market governments issued $124 billion in hard currency debt during the first 6 months of 2020, with two-thirds of the borrowing coming in the second quarter. The U.S. public debt, on the other hand, hit a peak not reached since the Second World War. The UK government borrowed a net £36.1 billion in September, pushing the total for first 6 months of the year to £208.5 billion. That's the highest figure since records began in 1993. The increase in average debt ratio in the euro area is estimated to be more than 15%, bringing it over 100%. It will climb by about 20% in France and about 30% in Italy and Spain. Governments will have to find ways to repay these debts, something that won't be easily achieved. One option could be to impose monumental tax increases. And who will bear the burden? As always, it will be the middle class. Just like U.S. tariffs on Chinese products were paid by American consumers. In the end, these debts will cause future deficits and will sap the financial strength almost of every economy. Even the U.S. might have to face the paying much more in interest than previously forecast. Thus, this money won't go to hiring teachers or paying for hospital stays for the elderly. Researchers suggest that governments will have to optimize revenue streams and contain some public spending. They also believe that using only tax increases to fund the deficit would raise taxation by 50%, which would hurt taxpayers, limit corporate investment, and reduce national competitiveness. The crazy thing is that Americans appear not to be much more concerned about the deficit than they have been in recent years. The study suggests that just under half of American adults, about 47%, called the deficit a very big problem, down from 55% in the autumn of 2018. In conclusion, it is clear that efforts taken so far to resolve the current problems have just postponed the ultimate consequences until sometime in the future. If countries continue to increase their debt levels, they could have trouble raising cash at affordable rates. Other consequences could be depressed economic output and increased risk of a fiscal crisis. Having said that, despite the fact that markets are overly positive, the situation is far from being the best, and the real consequences might be yet to come. Thank you.
for thought.
Salam, dear listeners. On the blessed 5th of Jamadi al-Awwal, the birth anniversary of Prophet's granddaughter, Hazrat Zainab, peace be upon her, who because of her piety and devotion to God Almighty was known as Zahida and Abida, the devoted, she found little of interest in worldly adornments, always preferring the bliss and comfort of the next world, and would say, "The life of this world is like a resting place to relieve fatigue along a journey."
Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Spiritual message of Islam.
His door is open no matter who you are. Just take the first step, you'll see it's not so far. If we all open our eyes to see, he is all that we need right now. And we can all come together somewhere, somehow.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. La hawla wa la quwwata illa billahi al-aliyy al-azim. Alhamdulillahi rabbil alameen. Wa sallallahu ala sayyidina wa nabiyyina Abil Qasim al-Mustafa Muhammad. Wa ala alihi al-tayyibin al-tahirin. La siyama baqiyyatillahi fil aradin. Ajjalallahu ta'ala farajahu al-sharif. Wa ja'alana min a'wanihi wa ansarihi wa shi'atihi. Last night we continued our discussion about the plan of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala for having a society for mankind in which justice and then other values which come under justice would be implemented. And we talked about the historical role of the Prophet Ibrahim alayhi salam. We talked about the Prophet Muhammad. We talked about the central role of Mecca in this plan. And the last verse that we discussed was from Surah Baqarah, verse 143. أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم وكذلك جعلناكم أمة وسطا لتكونوا شهداء على الناس وَيَكُونَ الرَّسُولُ عَلَيْكُمْ شَهِيدًا. As you remember, we said before this sentence and after this sentence, there's a discussion about change of qibla, direction for prayer. And Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, inside this discussion, makes a very general point. So Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala says, we have made you a middle, a balanced nation. Allah has planned in the way that Rasul is shaheed for us, he's a witness for us, and by following him, and in particular by making sure that we don't go to any extreme, then we become example for other people. This shows how balance is important.
among many other qualities, Allah says this is one of the central and fundamental qualities. I decided to read a few hadiths about this important point, and I hope, inshallah, we all rationally follow this discussion. You know, I am very worried that people, you know, may sometimes misunderstand this important point, but I have responsibility to say this in any way. Imam Reza alayhi salam, in his famous hadith to Ibn Shabib, you must have heard part of this hadith because frequently mentioned about Imam Hussein alayhi salam. Ya Ibn Shabib, in kunta baqiyan fabki lil Hussein ibn Ali. Then Imam continued and reached this point. Ya Ibn Shabib, fahzan li huznina wafrah li farah. وَعَلَيْكَ بِوِلَايَتِنَا. But this is not enough. This is to begin with. The most important thing is wilaya. عَلَيْكَ بِوِلَايَتِنَا. You have to follow us. It's not just enough to cry for someone or to, you know, laugh and smile for someone. Sometimes we feel very sad for some people, but we don't follow them. We see on the, for example, on TV, we see, you know, poor people in some countries. We feel very bad. We cry for them. But are we going to follow them? I see an orphan who has lost his parents in an earthquake. I'm going to cry, really. But I'm going to follow that orphan? So to have this emotional relation is important, but the most important thing is wilaya. In our own family, when my brothers, my sisters, my children, my cousins, my uncles, aunts, they have problem, I cry for them. But I'm not going to follow them necessarily. Wa alayka bi wilayatina, you have to follow us.
Oh, what a wonderful world this would be if we all open our eyes to see. He is all that we need right now, and we can all come together somewhere, somehow. His door is open no matter who you are. Just take the first step, you'll see it's not so far. Down this road that holds all the answers. Open your heart to something greater. His holy book speaks pure and true, and always tells us what we must do. His last prophet was sent as a guide, an example by which we abide. There is salvation for those who seek to find the one and only source of peace and understanding of why we are here, who created us, who we must fear. So what a wonderful world this would be if we all open our eyes to see. He is all that we need right now, and we can all come together somewhere, somehow.
Sometimes you see that there are people who love Ahlul Bayt, but to a limited extent. They love only on the surface. They cry for Ahlul Bayt. They celebrate their happy occasions. But when it comes to their lifestyle, they don't follow the example of Ahlul Bayt. They have other lifestyles. The way they dress, the way they keep their houses, the way they relate to opposite gender. Nothing is like Ahlul Bayt. So this is not enough. Alayka bi wilayatina, you have to follow us. So love can be verified, can be approved when leads to obedience. I say to one alim, for example, Maulana, I love you. I'm very much, you know, interested in you. He says, thank you very much. Then he says, now that you love me, my dear son, please say your salat, you know, on time. No, Maulana, you know, I have, you know, busy life. says, okay, please, you know, don't look at Namahram. No, Maulana, you know, I have, you know, unfortunately, you know, this pressure from inside. I have to look at Namahram, you know. I'm getting to married, so I have to see thousands of ladies. Maybe one day I choose one of them. So this Maulana, whatever he says, I say, I love you, I respect you, but I do my own things. This person is saying, are you ridiculing me? What type of love is this? What type of respect is this? You respect me, but you do your own things. I prefer if you don't respect me and listen to me. It's better if you shout at me, but you listen what I say. So how can we say to Ahlul Bayt that we love you, but we do our own things? We say to Imam Hussein, we love you, but we are not like you to stop even the battle and say our prayer on time in Jama'ah. We are not like that. We are not even able to stop watching a football game. So how can I say I am following Imam Hussein? Is it acceptable? Imam Hussein alayhi salam is welcoming his enemies and giving them water. And we are denying even love and mercy to our own, you know, people. Sometimes you see, you know, husband and wife have problem and it leads, you know, to separation. Then this man is not giving right of divorce to the lady and says, you know, till end of your life you have to suffer. I'm not going to divorce you. This is the school of Ahlul Bayt. In any way, this has come to an end. You are not going to live together. So why she should suffer till end of her life? How can you do this with a lover of Ahlul Bayt? How can you do this with an animal that you make that animal for end of life imprisoned? It's not possible. So we have to always try to follow the example of Ahlul Bayt alayhi salam. Not just, you know, say we cry for you. وَعَلَيْكَ بِوِلَايَتِنَا.
I'm looking back throughout the years to breathe is hard and my eyes are choked with tears. Your face and hair are full of light. Now it will soon be time to go. I feel you feeling calm now. Did the angel let you know?
Oh Allah, please send your salutations to Muhammad and all Muhammad. Oh Allah, please forgive us. Please forgive all our sins and mistakes and shortcomings. Please enable us to serve you with full honesty and truthfulness and sincerity. Please include us among the best followers of Muhammad and Ali Muhammad. Please protect and safeguard our community and our families and our youths from everything that you don't like. Oh Allah, please hasten the reappearance of Imam Zaman Ajjalallahu Ta'ala Farajahu Sharif. Please make our Imam Zaman happy with what we do and what we say. Please answer his du'as for his faraj. Please give shifa to all people who are ill. Please give shifa to people who are ill in their body and in their soul. Oh Allah, please send your rahmah, your forgiveness to all who have passed away, especially brothers and sisters who were attending these majalis in this community and other communities. Our parents, our foreparents, our teachers, our ulama, our maraji, those who have passed away. Please let them be with Muhammad and Ali Muhammad right now. And please give long life and blessed life to the parents and to the teachers and maraji who are alive. Oh Allah, please make the last moment of our life the best moment of our life. Wa akhiru da'wana an alhamdulillahi rabbil alameen.
My ummah, he will say. Rasulullah on that day, even though we've strayed from him and his way. My brothers, my sisters in Islam, let's struggle, work and pray. If we are to bring back the glory of his way. Ya Allah, Ya Rabb al-Alamin, Ya Rahman, Ya Rahman.
الرحيم يا ربي لدي أمة رايزك
يا الله
يا رب العالمين يا رحمن يا رحيم يا ربي لدي أمة رايزك لتصي دليلتك once again.
First suspended, now reinstated, but without the whip. Jeremy Corbyn has been at the center of an anti-Semitism smear campaign that has plagued the Labour Party. How did this begin and what led to the suspension of the former Labour leader? I'm Richard Medhurst, and this is The Communique. The Equalities and Human Rights Commission is the UK's watchdog on racism. After years of allegations that the Labour Party was becoming a hotbed of anti-Semitism under Jeremy Corbyn, in May 2019, the EHRC launched an inquiry. Last month, it published its findings in a report. In the report, the EHRC accuses Labour leadership of political interference in anti-Semitism complaints, failure to provide adequate training to those handling anti-Semitism complaints, and harassment of those who complained. In a report that is 130 pages long, the EHRC found two cases of anti-Semitism in the Labour Party. Now, granted, that's two cases too many. Anti-Semitism is wrong. Racism is wrong. Nonetheless, this doesn't match the description that we've been hearing from the British media and political establishment for the last couple of years that Jeremy Corbyn is an anti-Semite or that he fostered a culture of anti-Semitism in the Labour Party and that this was widespread. Those are two completely different things. And when Jeremy Corbyn pointed this out, the day of the report's release, he was suspended.
The numbers have been exaggerated, in my view. The public perception in an opinion poll last year was that one third of all Labour Party members were somehow or other under suspicion of anti-Semitism. The reality is it was 0.3% of party members had a case against them which had to be put through the process. And so I think it's clear that we do not accept, I do not accept, Keir Starmer does not accept, none of us accept anti-Semitism in any form whatsoever in our party.
To talk more, I'm joined by Israeli-American author and activist Miko Pellid. Hi, Miko. Thanks for coming on. It's good to have you.
Sure. It's a pleasure to be with you. Thank you.
Miko, can I just get your initial thoughts and reaction on Jeremy Corbyn being suspended and his statement that the problem of anti-Semitism was dramatically overstated for political reasons. Do you agree with that assessment? Do you think that's an accurate statement?
Well, I think the accusations of anti-Semitism were all completely and utterly false. They had nothing to do. The attacks against him, which I believe has been in place for at least till since 2016, and against all of the people that supported him in the party, in other words, his entire support network, had nothing to do with anti-Semitism or racism. He and all of his supporters do not have a racist bone or an anti-Semitic cell in their bodies. This was a politically motivated witch hunt against anybody who might stand up for the rights of Palestinians, anyone who has progressive views on the issue, anyone who dares to criticize Israel or threaten Israel in any way, shape, or form. And the idea that an activist like him, a man of conscience like him, would occupy Downing Street 10 was, you know, the Zionists' worst nightmare, and they were not going to allow it to happen.
If we look at the International Holocaust Remembrance Alliance, their working definition of anti-Semitism formed the backbone of the EHRC, and this definition was also adopted by the Labour Party in 2018. Now, underneath the definition, there's a few examples of what they consider to be anti-Semitism. I quote here, denying the Jewish people their right to self-determination, for example, claiming the existence of the State of Israel is a racist endeavor. Miko, you were born in Israel. You come from a very important Israeli family. You're Jewish. And you're a very staunch critic of Zionism, of Israel. And you've also said that Zionism is racism. So, I mean, does that mean you're anti-Semitic now, according to their definition?
Yes, absolutely. But I think it's important to clarify, Zionism is not an expression of Jewish self-determination. Zionism is an expression of Zionist self-determination and the self-determination of Israelis, not of Jews. And so what they've done is they framed it in a way that to defend themselves and also to gag anybody who would even think to criticize Israel with this definition. So now if you tell the truth, which is that the state of Israel has no legitimacy and is founded on a racist ideology, you're automatically anti-Semitic. But both of these claims are true whether they call you anti-Semitic or not. But yes, definitely, according to their definition, I am, and many of my people I respect, and certainly Jeremy Corbyn and others, and all the Palestinians, by the way, every single Palestinian is also anti-Semitic.
So, Miko, we know that the neoliberals in the party, the Blairites, have tried very hard to get rid of Jeremy Corbyn. However, how extensive would you describe the role of the Zionist lobby in getting Jeremy Corbyn suspended? Because, you know, a lot of people know what AIPAC is in the U.S., for example, but I don't think they really understand that Israel also plays a political role in the United Kingdom.
Well, there are AIPAC equivalents in every single country in Europe. And obviously, Britain is a very, very crucially important country. And so there are the same kind of Zionist agents working there as there are in the United States. You have what they call the Board of Deputies of British Jews. You've got different Zionist groups within the different parties, the Labour Party and excuse me, and so on. So they work and they actually work very closely with the Israeli embassy. In order, right. And there's no question that as soon as it was clear that Jeremy Corbyn was going to lead the Labour Party, they were going to do everything they possibly could to make sure he would not enter Downing Street 10. And the New Liberals, the Blairites, of course, were great allies, and they were happy to work together. There's no question about that.
Ayelet Namias Verben, she's a member of the Knesset, the Israeli Parliament, and just after Corbyn was suspended, there's a video of her boasting, essentially, that she played a role. She was a piece of the puzzle, as she says, in getting him suspended. What's your reaction to that video? What did you make of that?
It's not surprising because this is well known. I mean, Israel did everything they possibly can, and they're proud of their so-called accomplishment. They see this as an accomplishment. The bringing down of a man who his entire life, who dedicated his entire life to fight racism and fight injustice, is what they take pride in, because the state of Israel represents racism and injustice. And so what is absurd here, that people who represent the state of Israel or different aspects within the Israeli political spectrum, who are racists, who are engaged in a racist, in operating and maintaining a racist state, who are engaged in what can only be described as genocide, ethnic cleansing, and apartheid, are accusing Jeremy Corbyn, who spent his whole life fighting these things, as racist and anti-Semitic. And what is very, very, very worrisome is that they succeeded. They succeeded in a very big way, and the rest of the world is watching this and just nodding instead of standing up and saying, "Are you out of your minds? This is absurd."
Miko, how do you feel that this political witch hunt against Jeremy Corbyn fits into the larger scheme of actually fighting anti-Semitism globally?
Well, look, anti-Semitism is a form of racism. I mean, if somebody's an anti-Semitic, they're probably racist against everybody else too. Racism is racism. And so I think what's important is to fight racism and to promote tolerance everywhere, which of course this is why Israel is not, as they some people claim, the response to the Holocaust. Number one, most Jewish people who survived the Holocaust did not go to Israel. And number two, another racist regime is never a response to a racist regime somewhere else. What we need is more tolerance. What we need is to fight racism. What we need is to fight bigotry and to resist violence and so forth. So, you know, fighting racism is important everywhere. It's a problem everywhere. Racism, anti-Semitism, all forms of racism are problematic, and they all need to be fought with the same vigor, with the same passion that Jeremy Corbyn actually displayed his entire life, and the people around him that were also brought down displayed their entire life. So if people really care about anti-Semitism, Jeremy Corbyn is their man.
Thanks very much for coming on, Miko. Appreciate your time.
Anytime. Thank you.
Jeremy Corbyn has made it extremely clear on many occasions that he opposes anti-Semitism and that it has no place in the Labour Party. Jeremy Corbyn is someone who's fought against racism his entire life. He's known for that, both in the UK and outside, internationally. This is a guy who has fought against racism in all forms, against anti-Semitism. He's championed the rights of workers. He's an anti-imperialist. He's an anti-war voice, an advocate for peace. Despite this, despite Jeremy Corbyn's unimpeachable record, the British media, the British political establishment, and the Zionist lobby have spent the last couple of years attacking him relentlessly and trying to smear him as either an anti-Semite himself or someone who enabled a culture of anti-Semitism in the Labour Party. I mean, I myself have criticized his handling of the issue, but to call the man a racist or that he is someone who enables racism is utterly absurd and ridiculous. What this all comes down to is the neoliberal establishment, the British media, the Zionists will be trying to get rid of pro-Palestinian voices, trying to get rid of and purge the actual left within the Labour Party.
Communique is a program in which Richard Medhurst, the independent journalist and political commentator, gives his views of controversial issues of our time and interviews famous politicians and personalities. This program is broadcast every Sunday by IRIB English Radio.
Anti-Semitism is a serious issue and it should be opposed by the Labour Party. Fighting against racism is a fundamentally leftist value. And that's why we shouldn't confuse anti-Semitism with anti-Zionism, which is unfortunately what the media, what Keir Starmer, the now Labour leader, is doing. Keir Starmer himself has said that he is a Zionist without qualification. This man is a clear supporter of the Israeli apartheid state, and the last couple of years, we've seen not just Corbyn, but other voices championing the rights of Palestinians being purged, being kicked out of the party, being reprimanded, being suspended. There's a clear drive here to get rid of people who stand up to the ethnic cleansing of Palestinians by the Israeli occupation. Chris Williamson, who's also a former Labour MP and a close friend of Jeremy Corbyn, was also unfairly suspended from the Labour Party. Chris is a staunch anti-imperialist. He's a real leftist, and he's fought against racism his entire life as well. I'm joined by him now. Hi, Chris. Thanks for coming on.
Thank you for inviting me. I appreciate it. It's a real honor. Thank you. I mean, I'm a big admirer of your work.
I really appreciate it. Thank you. Chris, can I just get your initial thoughts on the EHRC report and Jeremy being suspended?
Well, I mean, the EHRC is a discredited organization. It's a partisan organization. It's been accused of institutional racism. It doesn't have any black or Muslim commissioners on its board. And indeed, two of the black and Muslim commissioners that it did have on the board were removed because they were deemed to be too loud and vocal about issues of race. They're very close to the Conservative Party, had a strong relationship as well with the New Labour, former New Labour government, New Labour regime, and they've come forward with a partisan report. I mean, I think the conclusions are written before the report had actually really, you know, seen the light of day, frankly. At the end of the day, they were trying to make the assertion that the Labour Party had a massive problem with anti-Semitism, that it was institutionally anti-Semitic. They didn't make that finding about institutional anti-Semitism, but they did actually argue that Labour was guilty of unlawful conduct and harassing the Jewish community based on two questionable cases, it's got to be said. They had six people initially in the initial report, six. And as a result of the legal representations that I made, they removed my name and three others. And they were left then with two people. And the way the corporate media has covered this is if this is some terrible, shaming revelation about institutional anti-Semitism inside the Labour Party when it's anything but. I mean, even if you accept at face value, two people out of a membership of 500,000 hardly constitutes a major problem for the Labour Party.
I wanted to ask you more about how you litigated and got your name removed from the report. Can you tell us more about that?
Basically, we threatened them that if they didn't remove my name,